Hello, everybody. Welcome to For the Girls. We are so honored to have Callum Nicholas, or on Instagram, F1 Mech. So you're probably very familiar, but he is with us today, a very well-known face in the F1 paddock, a multiple-time world champion as a senior power unit assembly technician at Red Bull Racing, responsible for the build of all the race and test engines and part of the pit crew. So we can't wait to get into what all of that means. It's a hugely important and complex role. And Callum, you've built quite the following. So we're just so honored to have you here. Welcome. And thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. That was a great intro as well. It's like really well informed. You've answered so many people's questions already. We just call it a day.
We're done.
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, it's good. Thanks for having me.
Well, first off, on that note, could you give some of our listeners who might not be as familiar with your role a rundown of what exactly it means to be a power unit technician?
Yeah, so in my current role, essentially, I'm the responsible party at the circuit for making sure that our engines are built or sort of dressed, as we like to say, in the correct specification for each weekend. So like there'll be lots of pipe work, heat shields, all sorts of other assemblies that need to be built onto an engine in order for it to sort of integrate with the chassis. So my role looks after looking after those as power units and then the cooling systems and all the other pipe work and bits that are required to plumb that engine into the car. So I'm responsible for the build of that and also like the servicing. So scheduling, servicing in between events, getting parts back and forth and making sure everything's sort of as it needs to be each week.
And that is obviously a massive effort, traveling all around the world, getting everything set up. And a huge part of that conversation is going to be reliability, which is something that we've been seeing a lot about, you know, in the past couple of years with a lot of other teams. And we really think that Red Bull is really set apart there. So what do you think about week after week to ensure top-notch reliability? And, you know, why is Red Bull so good at that?
Well, I think, look, the first thing is you find a routine. So I've been in my role now for quite a few years. And I think the thing that makes me consistent each week is having a routine. And, you know, you expect things to change and you might need to adapt and things don't go your way or whatever. But for the most part, being able to do like my routine for each part of the race weekend is sort of, that's what helps me provide consistency. You know, like I want to deliver the same product each week to the car that gets built. And that's sort of the way that I sort of go about it, is by having a routine for certain jobs that I do at certain times and sort of trying to stick to that where I can. Obviously, there are certain times when that's not possible. You know, like you might have a part failure or something unexpected and you have to adapt. And then in those sort of situations, it just becomes like a real team effort. Like when things can get messy and you've still got to deliver what you've got to deliver, but things can be a bit messy. It's sort of one of those moments where you see the whole team come together to get a job done. But yeah, in terms of the mindset, it's really just we take each race as it is. Each week is each week. Like the past races don't matter. The next ones don't matter until you get there. It's sort of looking at the here and now each day.
Yeah, that's amazing. And we can't wait to dig more into all of those details. But rewinding a little bit, tell us how you got into motorsport in the first place. We read about your first Grand Prix that you attended and how that kind of was a turning point for you. But tell us about that and how was that kind of an unlock for the rest of your career so far?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's fair to say that even as a kid, like I loved things that were mechanical. I was always that kid that would take stuff apart, you know, and anything that I had, a toy or whatever, I'd break it because I'd take it apart. And it'd be many years until I got to the point where I could put this stuff back together. But I was always that kind of sort of mechanically minded kid. I want to see how stuff worked. But by the time I left school, I'd been, you know, doing road cars and I'd sort of fallen into a little bit of a malaise, if you like, you know, like I was comfortable. I was just happy. I was, you know, trickling along, not particularly ambitious. And then I got the opportunity to go to Silverstone Grand Prix in 2009. And I was doing the pit lane walk prior to the race. And I sort of remember just watching all the mechanics setting up, getting ready for the race, getting the grid trolleys ready. A couple of teams were doing pit stop practice and it was sort of stood there watching that. You know, I was a mechanic in a local road car garage, but I sort of looked at the jobs they were doing and I thought to myself, you know, I could do those jobs. You know, like I was looking at these jobs and thinking, you know, okay, they might have some qualifications and more experience than me, but ultimately those are jobs that I can look at my skill set and I can do. I can do all of that stuff that they're doing. So that was the sort of spark for me to sort of begin pursuing a motorsport career. That was what sort of gave me the kick in the ass to say, all right, well, if you want to not be in a road car garage, you know, up to your elbows in grease for the rest of your life, then this is sort of your opportunity and the kick in the ass you need to just get on with it. That was a massive turning point for me.
Quick follow-up there. So when you were watching the pit crews doing all the things that they do and the whole garage setup at that weekend, you recognized, like, you understood from your experience as a road car mechanic, like, you could see the things that they were doing, you knew what they were doing, or was it kind of a little bit nebulous still?
Well, no, even, you know, like, the simple things that you see teams doing prior to a race, like, you're getting the bodywork on, you're getting it on the deck, you might, you know, be doing little jobs, you know, before Part Fermé and the regulations at that time, you might have been doing little jobs on the car that you could do more so than now. But yeah, it was just sort of, I'm watching these mechanics doing basic, essentially basic maintenance and repair work. And I'm thinking, they're doing the same job that I'm doing, but they're doing it in this amazing environment on these, you know, the fastest cars in the world. And I just sort of recognized that I could, that was sort of the moment where I thought to myself, well, I could take my skills and go and do that stuff and hopefully earn more money.
For sure.
So now that you're with Red Bull, what is your typical race weekend like? Are you at all 24 races a year? What does it kind of look like from when you show up midweek to lights out?
Yeah. So firstly, every race this year, pre-season testing, every event. There will be some in-season like tire tests and stuff like that you'll have to do. So it's a pretty busy year. For in total,
that's an understatement for sure.
Yeah, the sort of the ballpark figure, I haven't counted this year, but the ballpark figure I had in my head from last year was, it was like 180 days that we were away for. You know, we've got an extra race this year. It's full on, you know. There are some teams where staff rotate and things like that. I've always sort of taken the view that if I'm in, you know, like if I sign up for the season and I'm there, you know, that's what I've chosen to do. So I've never really wanted to rotate in and out of the role. The week routine, really, sort of, I tend to travel on a Tuesday. Depending on where you're going in the world, sometimes I might travel on a Monday. So like Japan, I'll be traveling on Monday. Australia, we had to travel on the Sunday. But usually your first day in the garage is Wednesday. So Wednesday is really a case of get the car built. So all of the bits that we've taken apart prior to the end of the last race, before we put everything in the freight, is get all those bits back together, read your build specification, make sure you've got all the right bits. And that sort of will take up your whole Thursday. So your day might start at 7:30 and your curfew might be 6:30 that evening. So that really...
Are you ever taking all the parts out of the freight thinking, oh no, or something's missing or something got damaged? Or is it such a well-oiled machine that everything, you can just trust the shipping every time?
Well, we're quite good at it. And, you know, we have whole sort of areas in the design office where people look at shipping and logistics and tracking, the tracking of parts. And even like, you know, down to the packaging, you've got designers that are designing packaging to make sure things can travel race to race. So it's not a massive... It's not a massive worry that stuff will get like damaged in the air freight. But I tell you what you do have to be careful of is sometimes when you're packing air freight, especially if it's like raining when you pack up, you have to be really careful that everything doesn't arrive. Like there'll be certain bits of pit equipment and tools that could arrive at the next race rusty. So sometimes what you might like you'll close the container and you'll throw like a load of silica gel bags in the container just to sort of soak up any moisture. Like little tricks, things like that, just to try and stop things
from
going
rusty. That is such a good fun fact. Wow.
Yeah. So you do have to be a little bit careful of that. But we're quite lucky at Red Bull. So we have a setup crew. So we have like a group of technicians that will arrive earlier than us. They'll be in the garage normally on a Monday and Tuesday.
Okay.
And they're the ones actually unloading the freight and getting the garage itself built. So they'll be in like a couple of days before us. And then they tend to sort of go home when we arrive. And then we pack it all up and we go to the next one and start all over again. But yeah, Wednesday's spent building the car. Thursday tends to be a day of legality checks, all the Leica scanning, setup work, getting everything sort of as we expect it to roll out of the door on Friday morning. And then Thursday, our last job of the day tends to be our big pit stop practice. So it'll be the first time of that week where we'll run through all of the different things we can do in pit stop practice for like nose changes, penalty stops, anything that could occur. That's the day we'll sort of practice all of that stuff, because then every other day from then on, we'll tend to just do like a performance practice. So we'll just practice normal pit stops up until the race. Friday, obviously, yeah. P1, straight into it Friday morning. You tend to have a few jobs sort of hanging over from Thursday night. If you wanted to get out of there and go and have dinner on Thursday, you'd just be like, oh, we'll do that Friday morning. So yeah, you tend to have a few bits and bobs Friday morning. And then once you're into practice, you know, the sort of the rest of the week becomes quite regimented, in that your session times are your session times. You know, in between those, you're just going to be doing small jobs. And then we're quite lucky now that we have the curfews that we have at the end of every evening. You know, there's only so long we can be at the circuit. When I first started, curfews have sort of only just been introduced. So like, let's say even if you started at 6:30 or 7 in the morning, the curfew could still be like 1 a.m. or like 1:30 a.m.
Wow.
So yeah, when I first started, it was like, it was perfectly normal on a Friday, especially was the worst. It was perfectly normal on a Friday to do like a 16, 17 hour day.
Wow.
Who sets the curfew hours?
So it's part of the regulations. So it's part of the sporting regulations. So each year they sort of look and say, well, we're trying to get, I think what's happened is as the calendar's expanded, there has to be some sort of method by which you're saying to people, you know, you can't be working this many hours. It's not,
right.
It becomes a health and safety issue as well. You know, that's right, why curfews were first introduced, because teams were working so many hours and it's only a matter of time before mistakes happen and things like that.
And so how does that work with a race like Vegas, where you have a drain cover come loose in FP1 and you're up all night? Do they do anything in that scenario?
I mean, in that circumstance last year, they did still set a curfew. They just moved it. They said, look, you know, we need to get some running done on track. I think the teams needed the running as much. I don't think it was just a thing of, oh, we want to give people a show. I think, you know, Friday practice, they're important sessions for the teams. So we have to get the practice done.
So I wanted to go back when you were mentioning pit stop practice. So you have held the world record for fastest pit stop in F1, which is amazing. So how does one train to be the best pit crew in the world? Like, what does that training look like? And what does that practice look like?
And also, can you walk us through what your particular role is on the pit crew?
I do the wheel guard on the rear right corner. I've been doing that for 3 or 4 years now, but I've done various of other roles on pit crews over the years. In terms of the training for it, it's very much, I think people see it differently depending on the role that they're doing. So for me, I always find that cognitive training is the thing that I need the most. Mm-hmm. So I want to work on my focus. You know, my reaction time, all of those things are sort of the things that I think benefit me most in my role. The people doing like wheel on and wheel off, it's a lot of explosive strength. So they might do sessions that are important to them, that are physical sessions. For me, I think that in the wheel gun role, a lot of the action of it is sort of muscle memory. So I sort of just trust that my body knows what to do. I've been doing it for long enough to sort of be able to sort of do it on autopilot. And where my training is always focused is always up here, really. You know, like being able to focus when it's noisy and there's so much going on and there's, you know, you're in the middle of a race, there's always going to be a certain amount of anxiety, your knowledge of how, you know, the importance of each pit stop when you're in and when you're racing the guys next door. So that's where I tend to focus my sort of training, is calm. And, you know, like, I feel like meditations would probably be better for me than a half mile run. You know, it's very much, we always refer to it in the team, we've always referred to it as functional fitness, rather than just, you know, exercise day or whatever. It's important that the what you're doing is actually useful for your role.
Okay, friends, it's festival and concert season, and you know it's all about the boots this year. That's why you need to make Tecovas your number one place for festival style this spring. And don't forget to shop their seasonal and limited edition offerings, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. We love Tecovas. They have a first wear comfort, which basically means there's no break-in period. It's the best thing ever. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personal. personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's really no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it to a store, though, just visit tecovas.com, T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and they ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
We all need a little extra health boost sometimes, and Fleur Marché makes it easy for us to supercharge our wellness. Their botanical wellness patches have been such a fun addition to our routine. We just stick them on wherever we want. They have them for sleep, relaxation, focus, and other things. And the patch delivers ingredients to your body in a subtle but effective way, and the results last up to 12 hours. Fleur Marché also has botanical gummies and their new organic nutritional powder Green Machine. They only use the best ingredients and are tested for potency, contaminants, and heavy metals before and after production.
And one of our favorite things, we also love that the company is founded and inspired by women with the mission of helping us feel 100% every single day so that we can have full energy and crush it every day. Find your new wellness essentials at fleurmarché.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your first order site-wide with promo code FORTHEGIRLS at checkout. Orders over $50 also get free shipping. Go to Fleur Marché, FLEURMARCHE.com. Use code FORTHEGIRLS for 20% off your first order.
How often is it that a pit stop doesn't go exactly to plan? Because even with, I'm a huge Red Bull fan, I think you all have just consistently the best pit performance. But even then, it can range from sub 2 seconds to in the 3 seconds-ish. Yeah. And even a relatively fast stop, it can vary a lot. So what kind of accounts for some of that variation?
Well, so I think the variation in terms of those small, you know, somewhere between 3 seconds and 2 seconds, you know, you're talking about like a really small window of time. So like in that sense, you sort of accept that that's always going to be the case. Like I've always said, there's no such thing as the perfect pit stop. Like even the last time, you know, like McLaren, when they broke our world record last year, but when we held the world record, it was the same thing. There's always something you will look at. You'll look at the footage afterwards and you say, oh, we could have gone a bit quicker here. Or if the driver had just stopped a little bit further this way, or, you know, like there's always going to be something. So that's where that little variation is. And it really can be, you know, like we go through the week and even little things like trying to just say to the driver, oh, we need you to stop bang on the marks with you. And sometimes you're telling them that, you know, they might be 100 millimeters too long. You know, it's not a massive amount, but it makes all this, you know, when you're chasing such small margins, it all sort of adds up. So when you talk about that small variation, that's always going to be the case. You know, you can have a run where you can put them all. Our goal is always, you know, anything that around the 2 second mark, whether it be 2.1, those are good stops. You know, you really can't be out here complaining that you're putting in 2.1, 2.2 second stops. We'd love every stop to be 1.8 seconds, but it's just not the reality of the sport. You are asking a hell of a lot. It's a real feat of human performance, and so many people at the same time to get it right. You know, you're asking a lot.
It's insane. And we were commenting last weekend because I love watching the pit stops. And as spectators, like, who are we to be like, oh, 2.3 is so much slower than 1.5 a second. Like, we're human. Like, that's not the realm in which we operate. So it's unbelievable every way.
It's easy to do, though. Like, I watch other sports. Like, I watch golf and I'm like, oh, God, I can't believe it's seven foot from the pin.
The armchair expert phenomenon. Exactly. do you ever, is it always practicing with Max and Checo in the car? Does the pit crew ever train with someone else driving the car and in some other way, or is it always with the drivers?
Well, so during our practice sessions, like in, you know, every morning when we do practice, we have a mechanic who just drives the car in, we push the car in and practice like that. And in the factory, we've had the electric car for many years now to sort of drive it into the box and practice with. So you can put other people in it. I think live stops, you know, the in-session stops are always going to be the most representative for us. Because even, you know, between the two drivers, you stop over the weekend, each time they stop in the box, you sort of learn that one's going to be a little bit this way, one's going to be a little bit this way. And that's fine. You know, as long as you've had the time to sort of prepare for it and you remember it, then that's sort of to be expected.
Yeah. And how that's do you fine. Train for a double stack?
Again, We it's something that we practice in our sessions. In terms of the big differentiator with a double pit stop is that the gap between the cars. You know, if the gap between the cars is like 5 seconds, you know, then you're pushing your luck a little bit because someone's got to get out of the way to do the rear jack. But yeah, again, it's just something we practice throughout the week. And at the end of sessions, and so at the end of the practice sessions, after the drivers will go and do practice starts, it's quite a good opportunity to practice the double stop when both cars will be coming back to the box.
That was smart.
Yeah, that's amazing. So talk to us about the pit crew radio. Is every pit crew member hearing the same thing? Like, what's the moment in a race where you're getting the call, like Max is coming in, Checo's coming in, whatever it is?
So in terms of the radio that you hear between the engineer and the driver, so during practice and qualifying, I'll only listen to Max's radio. Once I get back from the grid on a Sunday, I'll listen to both cars' radios. So you have, like, sometimes they're just talking over one another, but you sort of get an idea of when a pit stop's coming. And then in terms of our warning, you know, you'll get a warning at like 30 seconds when you'll normally hear the engineer tell the driver to box. So you'll hear the driver say box, box, or you'll know anyway because they're talking about wing angle or stuff like that. So you get an idea it's coming. But then your first reaction to get out there to the pit box is from our sporting director, who will give us a 15-second warning. So you get 15 seconds.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, like, normally you're aware it's coming, like a lap ahead. Like, you might get a pit stop imminent call. So, like, you'll know that there's a pit stop coming. But in terms of when you move to get out there, it's a 15-second call.
No wonder it always looks like everyone's running out so fast.
Well, they're running for their lives.
It's one of those things. So, like, years ago when the teams couldn't hear each other's radios. So, like, now all the teams, they can hear each other's radios, like, to and back and forth to the driver. So to a certain extent, your competitors will know when you're planning on boxing. At least within a lap, they'll know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the term, in terms of us getting a late call for it, prior to that, prior to them being able to hear that radio, you'd want to leave it as late as possible so that the people in the garage next door didn't get a heads up that you were going to box that lap.
From seeing you prepping, yeah.
Yeah. So to a certain extent, you want to sort of not give the game away. But realistically, if teams really want to know, they can work it out.
Got it. That's so interesting. And how do pit crew members bond? Like, are there any like team building exercises you do to like work together as a team? Because it's such a choreographed dance.
Nice. In terms of the race team as a whole, we spend so much time together. Like, all that time you spend together, you know, you're traveling, you're in the same hotels, you're out on meals, you're at the track, obviously. So you sort of naturally have to bond anyway. You know, like, it's one of those things where you, I guess, bear in mind with other jobs where every night you might go home to your own house and not have to worry about your colleagues so much. It's very much your colleagues are going to be there the whole time. So you tend to bond a little bit anyway. So yeah, a day out or, you know, an evening meal might be a team building exercise, if you like. But we don't, you know, you don't, there's certain events we'll put on a year. Like, we tend to do like a barbecue in Austria. We call it the Trucky Barbecue. Like, our garage technicians will always put on a barbecue for us. And that's quite a good night. Everyone sort of has a bit of fun and tries to relax on like a Tuesday or Wednesday night in Austria.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, and obviously in all the people working back at the factory, the team are quite good at trying to put on events to get everybody unified. And yeah.
Do you feel like when you're traveling, I mean, you do get to travel all around the world and, you know, you're doing team dinners and getting out. Do you ever actually get to see that much of the place that you're going, or is it the focus just so intensely on the race weekend?
Look, I think, you know, especially like I said, with the curfew periods we have now, if you really want to get out and see a city, you can, you know, or see the place that you're at, you can find the time to do it. The schedule sort of varies. So when you're on double headers, in between those two races, at some point you're going to get a day off. So it just depends where you are for your day off, whether you fly straight after the race and have your day off in the next place, or whether you stay for a day. And that's sort of a decision that the team makes based on flights availability. But you can find days off to go and enjoy this stuff. Like, you know, I've been super lucky to have been around the world like, I don't know, 10 times in the last, you know, 11 years or whatever it is now. And I've got to see plenty of it. And don't get me wrong, there's some long days, some long work hours, but you do still find time if you want to go and explore and enjoy bits of the places you are.
That's so amazing. Okay, one more question about pit stops, because we've been seeing a lot of pit stops going wrong with other teams mostly. But what can cause a pit stop to go wrong? Like, when we're watching it as spectators, it's kind of just like a full commotion. And again, we're like, oh my God, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 5 seconds. What happens to make them go so wrong?
So many things. Like, if you think of a pit stop in what it is, right? So a car,
yeah, exactly.
A car's gonna drive towards you at like 60 kilometers an hour, and there's gonna be like 16 people stood around a box that's the same size of the car, and that car's gonna stop, it's gonna go up in the air, gonna change all four wheels, put it back down, and then it's gonna drive out the other side. Like, when you think of it like that, there's so many things that can go wrong. And I guess you break them down into human error or, you know, mechanical failure. Those are the things that we sort of, I worry about making sure that I'm doing what I can do, and it's not human error when I think of what I'm doing at a pit stop. There's so many things that could go wrong. You know, we could have a wheel gun failure or wheel nut failure, or it could fall off the jack. There's all of those things, but there's nothing that I can do about them. So I just don't think about them. You know, when they happen, I will work out how I'm going to deal with it. But for right now, I just need to make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing.
No, that's a good mentality.
Do you train for worst case scenarios?
It's something we tend to look at again at the beginning of the season, especially in pre-season testing. You might run over the things that we've seen in the past, to sort of learn from any lessons. You know, I guess that's the biggest thing, is when a pit stop goes wrong, you learn from it. You know, there's no reason why you should be having the same mistake twice. You know, it's something that you learn from the first time, and you either put a procedure in place, or you do whatever needs doing to make sure it can't happen again. And then let's see what props up next.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you all watch back footage. I mean, that makes total sense, but it's cool that you have that ability to see what exactly went wrong and how can we improve. So
it's a massive thing as well. So it's something that I do a lot. And because we, as well as the footage we have of every pit stop that we do, so practice, we've got an overhead camera, we can watch all of the pit stops. But on top of that, we also have, like, now at all the teams, you have data from your wheel guns. So you can see when you connected to the nut, how long the nut took to come off, how long it took to tighten it up, your reaction time, all of that stuff. And do you know what? The great thing about it is it becomes quite competitive, like internally competitive. So me and the other rear corner on the gunman, we've got like a WhatsApp group where we give each other shit like all the time about how it's gone. Like, and if you've had a good week, you'll be there straight away looking at the data, making sure that you can post something in the WhatsApp group to show how much better you are. And it becomes like really competitive. And it's good. It drives you forward. And, you know, whilst we are all one team, you know, that kind of competition can be really healthy.
Yeah. The pit crew trash talk game. I love it. That's incredible. Well, I want to ask one more thing, going back to power units, because obviously you're in charge of all of those. As we approach 2026 regulations, how is that top of mind right now for you? Are you still fully focused on, you know, season to season, race to race? Like, how do you prepare for such a big shift when it comes to power unit changes?
I tend to worry about the car that I'm building now. So each year you've got a new task, right? You got a new car, new parts, new systems, something like, you know, and even if the changes are only small, you know, it's every year you just look at it as a new assembly. So this is my goal for the year. This is what I'm looking after, my baby. Right? So I don't tend to look that far ahead. Like, certainly what I might do is towards the end of the season, you'd be more in contact with the design office. So you're thinking about things that could be better from this year. So you might communicate back, oh, if we could do this with this pipe rather than this way, it'd help us logistically, or it might help us time-wise, or, you might spot a potential fault, and you just make sure that gets fed back into the design office to improve next year's car. But I can't say I think much further than that. There's too many variables to try and think that far ahead. So I tend to sort of look 1 year ahead at most.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense. We have a lot of people ask for advice on breaking into the world of F1. So in terms of mechanics, car people generally, or just more broadly, people who are interested in getting into F1, do you have any particular advice for them?
I think the advice that I always give, and I sort of give the same advice whether you're in college or in university or neither of those things, the advice that I always give to people is the best way to start in motorsport is to start. So what I always tell people to do is try and find any form of motor racing that's near you, that's accessible to you, you know, whether it be a racetrack that does test days or a go-karting track, anything. I say try and just go and get involved in that as soon as you can.
Yeah.
So whether it be, like, I used to arrive at teams' workshops that are in around Silverstone and just pop my head in an evening and say, oh, look, if you're doing a race weekend and you just want someone to come and help out, whether it be running tyres, doing any of these jobs, that's the kind of stuff that I'd go and volunteer my time to do. All of your experience on your CV, like your experience is going to be one of your biggest assets when you do come to sort of, if you're thinking about applying to F1 jobs or other big series, your experience is going to be the most important thing for me on your CV. So if you can see that someone from, you know, age 16, 18 has been constantly at racetracks, doing bits, learning different disciplines, and every race car you work on, you'll learn something. You know, like they're all so different. You know, like I couldn't for like 1 minute think that I'd just rock up at a WEC showroom and just know exactly how their car worked and build it. Like, yeah, that's not going to happen. You know, everything is a different discipline, different set of skills required. So anything that you can build on your sort of CV as you sort of a resume, anything that you can build on your resume from sort of as early as you can. And it doesn't matter how sort of grassroots that motorsport is, it's all valuable. And as well as the experience, the people that you will meet and the networks you'll get will be so much more valuable to you as you go on. So yeah, that's always my advice, is find some motorsport near you and get involved.
Fabulous advice and great comment about the people that you meet too. It does kind of feel like the motorsport world, the F1 world is really small, but in a really good way. And everyone's always working together. It's been really fun kind of being a part of that in the past couple of years. Okay. Callum, rapid fire question time. We always do this with everyone that we chat with. You were lucky. We have to tell our listeners that you had a flavor of what we were going to ask you, but a few other ones thrown in. So don't worry, you will be caught slightly off guard.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, this is an easy one, but like, if from your perspective, what is the single most demanding part of being on the pit crew?
The pressure.
I don't know if that was an easy one. Yeah.
The pressure.
Yeah, I think the pressure. Look, you all the time, every pit stop, they don't all necessarily matter in terms of 1 second difference makes a difference. But the difference between doing a nice clean pit stop and an absolute disaster can destroy a race. And ultimately, over the course of the season, it can destroy a championship. So yeah, there's always going to be a certain amount of pressure there.
Yeah.
I just got chills.
Seriously. And hardest track for a pit crew, like whether it's the pit lane size or whatever it is their hardest Zandvoort. Track?
Zandvoort is the easiest one. Honestly, it's so small, the pit lane. So I know that there's a project there, I think, to build some more garages to try and extend that pit lane. But it's the first year we went there, it was super dangerous, you know. Once you got to race day, the cars were so close to you, all the people working on the outside corners as cars were coming in and out of the box, it was really tight. I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2022, where Checo, as he left the box, he clipped a spare wheel gun that was outside the Ferrari box. You know, like all of these things, it's super, super tight there. So that's the toughest, without a doubt, toughest pit lane, Zandvoort.
You got to get Max to wield his hometown influence and get them to change it.
Do a redesign. What about the hardest or easiest thing to repair on a race weekend?
Whichever gets repaired by a department that's not me. If I can send it home to the factory and have someone else to repair it, that is easier.
Very true. Very true.
It kind of depends what it is. I guess the thing that we have the most repairs are composites parts. So floors, bodywork, all of that stuff. We've got like some amazing people in our composites department. They're always super busy, as well as doing prep for next race and all the other normal jobs they have. I guarantee in at least one session, there's some bits going to come back broken and they're going to be covered in dust and working late and whatever. So yeah, shout out to composites.
Love that. What's your favorite race?
My favorite race to go to again is probably Zandvoort. I'm a little bit biased, obviously. It feels like it feels like hometown support when you're there. Everybody's a Max fan. So the atmosphere, but I think what Zandvoort did when they first came on the calendar, I think the promoter did such a great job of making the whole week almost feel like a sort of festival week. So, you know, loads of support races, but music and DJs playing all the time. The fan zone was going off. And I think what we've seen is we've seen so many races since then try and replicate that and sort of try and build that same atmosphere. But, you know, shout out to Zandvoort. That was something that, for me, they were the biggest and the best to do it. They sort of set the bar really, really high.
I really want to go. We did go to Austria last year, which was amazing. And not Zandvoort, but still a bit of a hometown advantage vibe for Max, which was really fun.
I think what Zandvoort has going for it as well is just the nature of the track. It feels really close. Like everything feels really close. So it's really good. I love it.
If speaking of music and DJs, do you have a favorite artist to listen to in the garage? Like what gets you going and pumped up?
I'm going to be honest, right? I don't mind. I listen to like any type of music pretty much.
Yeah.
But what we tend to have in the garage is sort of, you know, the Red Bull atmospheres. It tends to just be like banging house like all day long. Right. And that's fine. It's fine sometimes. It's fine sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes we get some drum and bass and some jungle and that's all good. But it's all like super high tempo music.
I just kind of picture the Red Bull garage with Max, Super Max.
Yeah, you know, we don't do that. I think that would annoy Max the most.
Yeah.
That would live in my brain. Eric's bumping in the background too.
But you know, the music's always like super high energy in the garage. We might like on a Wednesday or Thursday get some old school hip hop going or something like that. And that's sort of my happy place.
Yeah.
Very cool. Awesome. Any pre-race traditions, lucky charms, or rituals?
So I always like to say that I'm not superstitious, but it was...
Oh, everyone's superstitious.
Right, so I like to think that I'm not superstitious. I am very, like, routine-based.
Okay.
So, like, on a Sunday morning, I've got, like, a load of jobs that I need to do, whether it be race prep or whatever, and then from the time we do our morning pit stop practice... I'm in like a really rigid routine from that point on. So like I'll get my pit stop practice and then I'll quickly have a drink, get dressed in my pit crew suit. I'll go and have a cheeky cigarette and then I'll come back. And then from this point on, I'm just fully in my routine. I'll go and I tend to grab one can of Red Bull from the fridge. Like I treat myself one can a week. I'll go to the fridge and then what a lot of us tend to do is we tend to sit out on the pit wall. I really like it. Pre-race, I'll sit out on the pit wall. And I just feel like I sort of soak it all in a little bit. I try and enjoy the atmosphere and think about how the race is going to go wonderfully and just get in the right sort of mental state for it. And then from that point on, back to my routine, go and set up on the grid, car comes, and then all of the little grid procedures we do. And then the only thing that I always do, and I do it every week, and I've probably done it for like the last 5 years, right, is I will always give the bull a little tap on the back. Just about 90 Aww. Seconds. It's about 90 seconds to go. And do you know what? I'll tell you what. It started. It must have been longer than that now, actually. I forget how long I've been doing this. It must have been longer than that because it started in the era when we were running Renault engines.
Mm.
And there was no guarantee that you were going to make it to the end. So every week I used to get to the grid and I'd just be like, you've been good this week. You know, just keep going. You've been really good this week. Let's just one last push and let's get to the end. And that's just sort of carried on. So even though I probably don't need to do it to the Honda because they're wonderful, I can just sort of carry on doing it. I don't want the Hondas to feel left out. So every race, about 90 seconds to go, I give it a little pat on the ball.
Well, whatever you're doing is working, so don't stop.
And last rapid fire question. What is one thing that you wish fans were more aware of?
Do you know what? Probably that we don't all hate each other in the paddock. Like, I feel like a lot of fans see the rivalries on track and we see obviously what we've seen from Drive to Survive. And I feel it's very easy to forget that the community in the paddock is not like that at all. Like, I've got some of my oldest friends work for Ferrari. I've got friends at every team, people that you say hello to, people that you spend time with. There's a lot of love in the paddock, you know? I met my partner in the paddock. I know so many of my friends and my colleagues that have met their partners in the paddock. I feel like fans need to sometimes remember that there's still a lot of love there and we're not ever at each other's throats. We're all just getting on with it.
I love
that. That's so great.
Love that. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Callum. This has been absolutely incredible. We can't wait to watch you crush it in Japan next weekend and presumably the rest of the season. So thank you so much for your time and hopefully see you at a race soon.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure.